Hi, welcome to Influencers Cafe. I'm honored to have on again AJ, who's on the show a few weeks back, and we're talking about various virus-related topics, but we're talking again.
Hi, Nikos. Good to be here.
It's good to see you again, and how have you keeping the last 2 weeks then?
Yeah, honestly, not too bad. I've got a little bit of a cough, but I typically have respiratory and asthma problems off and on throughout the year, and so I'm pretty sure that's what this is. But I've been keeping to the house quite a bit. When I go out, we're starting to wear face coverings because, you know, that's what the CDC requested a few days ago. And so I think that's really good advice, and I've been following the advice as much as I can myself. Stay at home, cover my face if I'm out and about, and a lot of time to watch the talking heads talk about COVID and SARS and all things related, whether it's good or bad, and a lot of time to check in with friends and colleagues and family and just see how they're doing and how they're holding up, and to share some encouragement and prayers with people as they need it. So that's what I've been up to.
Yeah, how's your family doing?
Yeah, my family's doing pretty well. I think, based on not COVID testing or anything that certain, but based on symptoms and things, I think one of my brothers-in-law may have had it, and I think one of my nephews may have had it. But otherwise, I think everybody back in Oklahoma, which is where the vast majority of my family lives, they all seem to be fine, including my mother, who's in a full-skilled facility, like a nursing home. And they pretty much shut down visits to the nursing home about 3 weeks ago. And so they've been able to set up a system where three afternoons a week, one of the aides there will take a phone into my mom, and she'll hold it, and my mom and I will be able to FaceTime and communicate with each other that way. And so that's been actually brilliant, because normally I just get to talk to my mom on the phone and don't get to see her face to face. And both she and I have been enjoying the FaceTime sessions. So that's been good.
There was a nursing home in Scotland where I think 13 people died in the one home. It was dreadful, dreadful news. That was a couple of weeks ago or last week.
Yeah, that's where it started in the U.S. too, was in a nursing home in Washington State. And that was really sad. And I saw that coming as soon as they said they had a case in one of the aides and one of the patients there. It was almost certainly going to end as really bad news, and it did. Several individuals from that facility died. And I've really been praying a lot for nursing home staff, for nursing home patients. It's really tough to be cut off from your loved ones, but it's really necessary to protect them, right? So it's tough love, tough action.
Yeah, one of my friends who sent me a verse of scripture, I think it was Psalm 91, about those who dwell in the secret place of the Most High will be protected. So I do believe that there can be protection for people that are actively positioned within God's protection, I guess.
Yeah, I think we're certainly invited to pray along those lines that God would intercede and protect. But, you know, sometimes situations don't go the way that we hope and pray that they will go, and we just have to trust that God's at work in those situations too, certainly bearing our grief with us and giving us comfort. And I think the reassurance that if our loved one was in Christ when they died, that they're in a place of rest and peace in the presence of God, and that, you know, it's hard to lose them here. It's always hard to lose someone you love, especially to death. But, you know, relationships will be restored. That's part of the hope that we have in Christ. That's part of the truth of the Christian message, right?
So sure.
It's what Easter is all about, which is coming up in just a few days, right? Though we die in Christ, we're made new and transformed and resurrected into eternal life. And so, yeah, we have that Easter hope that we carry with us every day.
they're going to be, they says that the Vienna will be resurrected in next Monday because they're going to start opening some shops.
Wow. Yeah, that could be a bit early, but you know, if we keep practicing physical distancing and wear the face covers, it could probably be good to keep practicing hand hygiene and environmental hygiene, you know, wiping surfaces down and washing our hands, and it could be okay. I think, you know, I wouldn't recommend it on a wide scale level because you don't know how diligent people are going to be to do that and to still remain at home. And if they're sick, and you know, it's a little bit troubling because some of the data suggests maybe 50%, maybe even up to 80% of cases are little to no symptoms. And so we really have to continue to be diligent, even if society sort of starts to open up in some places.
Yeah, if we maintain the sort of semi-strict version of social distancing and hygiene, then we'll be protected to a certain degree from the next virus that surely will come. But then again, society might just forget pretty quickly, especially people that maybe, of course, the next generation won't remember how bad this is. So
that's true. The next generation won't. We tend to forget history pretty quickly. But yeah, it's not just, it will help protect us against the next one as long as we continue to implement it. And I think that, you know, in the school systems, when they reopen, it's certainly something we need to go back to emphasizing in schools, because if we repeat these things and we learn these things over and over again, then as a society, we can kind of hang on a little bit longer to the lessons learned. But I guess I'm still concerned that, you know, this particular outbreak isn't finished. And so, you know, some countries have it pretty well under control, but those countries, and right now I'm thinking of like Iceland, those countries are, even though they have it under control, once they open their borders back up again, when the globe doesn't have it under control, they run the risk of sort of reinitiating another local outbreak or another country outbreak in the case of Iceland. So you do everything right and you still have a large percentage of your population that's vulnerable because they're still naive. But, you know, we slow it down as much as we can. We practice the physical distancing and the hygiene the best we can. We wear the face coverings when we're going to be in crowded areas to prevent asymptomatic spread. And, you know, eventually we will have ways to treat it. We will have vaccines. We'll have some way to intervene from a medical perspective. That'll just take time. So
if you look at the strains map, there seems to be something like between 30 and 40 different strains identified in various countries. Is that a normal amount of strains variations for a virus?
Well, so, I mean, you've got to be really careful about what you call a strain, right? So typically, strains indicate, to a virologist, which is what I am, strain indication represents to a virologist usually that you have enough variation in the virus that it's going to impact the role of antibodies. And so, you know, if you have cross-neutralizing antibodies, you can sometimes have those to different strains, but typically strains are defined based on not having cross-neutralizing antibodies. And so what does that mean? It means if I get one virus, let's call it a strain for the sake of this conversation, let's say I get strain A, then my immune system is going to produce antibodies that recognize proteins on that virus. And usually those antibodies can be neutralizing. They can prevent the virus from infecting a cell or spreading from cell to cell. And those are called neutralizing antibodies. And if those same neutralizing antibodies that strain A produced are able to protect me from a different strain, let's say strain B, then those antibodies are referred to as cross-neutralizing. And normally, there are many exceptions, but normally it is an inability to cross-neutralize that defines the boundary of a strain. And so So I don't know that there is any indication whatsoever that there's more than one strain of this current virus. There are different mutations that are occurring.
Yeah, that's probably what it was. Yeah.
There are different mutations that are occurring in different isolates of the virus. And so we are seeing sequence variation among different isolates. But whether those sequence variations rise to the level of affecting the virus and the immune response to the virus, I haven't seen anything that indicates
right.
that yet.
Okay, that's good then.
Yeah.
How do we isolate a virus from an infected blood or sample or cell?
Yeah, so different methodologies for all three of those things you just mentioned. But let's say it's a nasal swab. You typically would take the nasal swab and put it into a solution, usually a media solution that's pH balanced, maybe something as simple as a phosphate buffered saline, which is just, you know, sort of a salt solution that's pH balanced. And then you usually will spin that sample down so that any kind of debris or junk that's in it settles to the bottom. And the virus is usually suspended in the solution because you have, well, you maybe you vortexed it. You put it in a machine that shook it up and spun it really hard just while you're holding it. It's sort of vibration type disruption. And that releases the virus into the solution. So you take the sample after you've vortexed it and sort of busted up what's in there, and then you spin it down really fast so that the debris settles to the bottom and the virus remains suspended in the solution. And then you take that solution and you transfer it to cells that you know will support the replication of the virus. And when you transfer it to the cells, you transfer it in different dilutions. And one of those dilutions will set up an infection where you're only getting a few virus particles on top of the cells that are there to set that will allow the virus to make more. And then you go in after you've allowed the virus to sit there for about half an hour, you go in and you add sort of a semi-solid gelatin on top. And that sort of holds the virus in place. It doesn't let the virus sort of continue to be released into the media on top of the cells and transfer to other cells. And then once you do that, you can actually go in and you can pick the virus through the gelatin and you can end up with a single clonal isolate. And so you can take that virus and you can sequence it. You can also sequence the sample directly. So you could take just the material that you take off the top once you spun the debris down. You could take that material and set it up in a sequencing reaction because you can amplify the viral signal there through something called a polymerase chain reaction. You have to reverse transcribe the RNA and then you amplify the DNA and you can actually sequence it directly from the sample too. But so it depends on what you want to do with the virus. Do you just want to know the sequence or do you actually want to have clonal isolates that you can use in experiments? And so I was sort of describing that second option first and then explaining sort of how you can just directly sequence from the sample if you want.
How long does it take to get good at actually doing this in a preparation room?
Yeah, so if you're doing the direct sequencing, it honestly doesn't take very long at all. It usually takes maybe no more than half an hour to prep the sample. And then what really takes the longest time is setting it up in the polymerase chain reaction and allowing it to amplify. That could take maybe a couple of hours, maybe 4 hours. And then you have to take what comes off of the polymerase chain reaction and do a little bit more manipulation of the solution, and you can send it off for sequencing. And again, sequencing can take, maybe a couple of hours. And so you're talking about maybe 8 hours of prep from the time you have the sample to the time you can have sequence.
Okay. And how long does it take to learn the skills to do all this stuff?
Honestly, those skills that I just referred to, you could probably learn if you were, pretty smart and you had somebody showing you how to do it. You could probably learn all of that in about a week.
Oh, that's surprising.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's technician type work. I mean, as long as you got somebody else understanding the science and what you need to add to what when, it's just a, you know, it's kind of like learning how to do a couple of new recipes and to do the recipes in the right manner so that you're not messing up the integrity of the experiment. Yeah, a couple of days, a week, if you're good, you know, so.
So when you take this virus and you put it into this sort of gelatin holding thing, do you then extract an individual virus for sequencing?
Yeah, so what you can actually do there, it's called, that process is called plaque purification, because what happens is the virus that infects the cell, so you have a monolayer, you have a thin layer of cells in a dish, and you're taking the solution with the virus at different dilutions and putting it in different dishes, and you're going to get one dilution where you have just a few virus particles, and they're going to sit down on different cells, sort of spread out on that layer of cells, and then the gelatin's holding those viruses in place so that the infected cells can still produce virus, and the virus that's produced in the cells that they landed on is limited in its mobility, and so it can only infect cells that are right next to the cell that it originally infected. Does that make sense so far?
These viruses can still move through the medium.
Yeah, they don't move. They don't move freely through the medium. They move in a way that's constrained to the spot that they first infected.
Yeah.
And so you let that plaque assay go for 2 or 3 days, and what happens is the virus is replicating in the cells. And when you pull it out and you look at it under the proper lighting, you know, it could just be a room light. The media is sort of colored. And the gel is colored as well. And if you hold it up to the light, you can actually see places in the cell layer where there's now a hole. And that hole is representing viral damage. And so then you can go from the top of the plate through the gel with like a little tiny glass pipe. And you can collect the gel on top of the spot where there's viral damage. And you know that what you got in that sample of gel now is from a single virus particle infecting that monolayer. And that virus particle has replicated, you know, hundreds of times. And you now have a bunch of virus that started from a single virus. And so that's how you get a single viral isolate or a clone. And so you end up having, you know, thousands of those virus particles, but you started with one to get those thousand. And so it wasn't like you just got thousands from a sample from a person, which could have sequence variation. You get one from a very controlled laboratory experiment. And if you want to be really sure you have a clonal population and not more than one strain, because it's not impossible that two virus particles sat down right next to each other and you ended up getting a mixed sample, you do something that's called triple plaque purification. And so you go through that entire process three times instead of one time. And if you go through it three times, then everybody is fairly convinced that you have a very pure clonal population of virus.
Yeah, you're reducing the odds of having a mixture there.
Right, exactly.
So I guess this is what they're doing around the world right now, trying to figure out what's going on, various laboratories.
Yeah, I think there are reasons that you want to have a pure clonal population if you want to start doing specific studies where you're looking to see if any of those mutations are making a difference as to how well the virus binds to its receptor or how quickly the virus replicates. You want to know exactly what you're putting into those experiments, and so you would take care to isolate different clones of the viral isolate to run those types of secondary experiments. But if you're really just trying to trace sort of the epidemiology of the case-to-case transfer, and one way you can do that is to just sequence the sample that you get. And whatever the major component is in the sample is going to be what gives you the strongest signal in your sequencing. And so you can do the direct sequencing of samples and kind of tell, well, this virus is following a pattern of mutation that traces back to China, or this virus is following a pattern of mutation that traces back to Italy or to Iran or to, you know, and so you can do, it's called viral epidemiology, where you're actually sequencing the virus sequences and tracing the history of that virus based on the mutations that you observe.
Well, hopefully we can stick to the science, but a lot of, it seems like governments are throwing verbal darts at each other now, saying, trying to blame each other. So hopefully the science can stay pure and it won't be manipulated.
Yeah, so, you know, it's an interesting question when it comes to political darts being thrown at each other and political darts being thrown between nations. So I think that there's, I want to be as correct as I can be based on what we truly understand about viral outbreaks in general and what we understand from the sequence analyses related to this particular virus. So I'm going to start again with the second part first. So the sequence analysis of this virus, no matter which isolate we're looking at, is telling us something very specific. It's telling us that this virus is highly similar to isolates from bats. And so the differences between this virus and the earlier SARS outbreak in 2002-2003, those viruses are still very similar to one another at a genetic level, about 80% similar. And so you look at the areas that are different and you say, are those areas that are different possibly related to like human manipulation? And we can take the virus sequence of the virus that's spreading now and compare it to virus sequences that are isolated from bats. And some of those isolates are as old as the original SARS virus from 2002-2003. And if we compare it to those sequences, we see sometimes as much as 95%, 97% similarity. And the areas that are different between the bat sequences and the SARS-2 sequences that we're sequencing now are sequence differences that are totally, completely consistent with natural sequences. So there is no sequence indication whatsoever that it's been manipulated by human intervention, right? And so those conspiracy theories that this was, you know, created to be more infectious in a lab, or it was a lab experiment that escaped or went awry, it's just completely unfounded speculation. And the only types of people that are making those speculations are not scientists. they're political watchdogs, or they're political figures, or they're Joe Schmo citizen that likes the idea of conspiracy theories. And so there's no scientist who actually understands the experiments and is conducting the experiments that goes in and looks at these sequences and says, this is human manipulation. And those few that have, other scientists have gone in and looked at their work and they've said, no, you've made improper conclusions. And let me tell you, there are plenty of scientists that do that. They go in, they look at the data, and they think, oh, this data indicates that there's been manipulation, because you see a similarity in this sequence from the SARS virus that is very similar to a sequence in a different virus, and that indicates that somebody went in and took this other virus piece and put it into a SARS virus. And that's not what it's indicating at all, because the degree of similarity is not that high between the virus they're trying to claim it came from. And virus, this next part is going to be a little bit technical, so just give me a minute to unpack it. But viruses that are completely different from each other will often share structural domains. So for instance, if a virus uses a receptor that's a specific receptor to get into a cell, and another completely different virus from a completely different virus family can also use that receptor to get into the same cell, then you would expect that there would be some level of similarity between the part of the virus, the two different virus proteins that attach to that common receptor to enter the common cell, right? So if that's true, then you would expect some degree of similarity for very short stretches of sequences, even though these two viruses are completely different than one another. And what they share in common is they share binding to a particular receptor, or they share structures that allow the virus to fuse with another, with the host cell membrane or with a fusion protein. And so the virus proteins might have something called fusion domains or fusion peptides. And it's a way that the virus actually gets into the cell and releases its genetic information. And so those fusion domains often share similar structures and similar functions, and that can also correspond to a very low level of sequence identity. And so you see these bits and pieces of similar sequences in very different viruses, and it doesn't indicate at all that the viruses have been manipulated by a human agent. It's that they have similar structures that are doing similar functions, and they share slight degrees of specificity and similarity with one another. So there's no evidence at all to anyone who understands viruses that there's been any manipulation by human beings in this current virus. Okay, so that was the second question. The first one was pointing fingers and trying to blame people. You know, to a certain extent, I think there is some responsibility for this outbreak that rests with the Chinese government. And I want to be very careful about what I say next, because I don't want everybody to think, oh, this is all China's fault and China needs to make reparation to the world. I don't think that that's true. You know, we can't always foresee how badly something is going to turn out. But there have been clear signs since the first SARS outbreak of 2002-2003 that the potential for a very serious pandemic could develop because of practices done in China, where they take wild animals and they domestically farm them, and then they bring them in close proximity to other wild animals and to domestic animals, while all these very different animals from very different places are being brought together in living conditions that are very close, very crowded, very unsanitary. And when you do that, what you're basically doing is you're setting up a very artificial environment where viruses can jump from one species into another species, that jump would never take place in nature, because those animals are never in close proximity to one another in nature. And so you crowd them together in a common place, and you set up a potential for virus to jump from one animal to another, and then you add humans into that mix, either caretakers or consumers, and you now have a really bad scientific experiment on a very large level where a virus can enter an animal it would never normally enter, and then that animal can serve as a stepping stone for entry into the human population. And this is exactly what happened in the original SARS outbreak. The virus originated in bats. It went through an intermediate host that was being sold in these markets in China, an animal called a civet cat. And then from the civet cat, it jumped fairly easily into humans. And then it was transmitted from human to human. In this case, we know again, because of the similarity of sequence, that the virus originated in bats. What we don't know, what's not clear, is if there was an intermediate animal this time, or if it jumped directly from bats to humans. But again, the first cases, the vast majority of those are centralized to or traceable to one of these markets. And so the thought is that it's happened again. And so the responsibility is that the Chinese government knows the risks involved. So when they went in the first SARS outbreak, we identified the animal as the civet cat. there was another animal that was also very susceptible and could have passed it to humans called a raccoon dog. And the Chinese government went in, they shut down the markets, they killed all of the civet cats. They've killed all of them on every domestic farm and in every market. They basically eradicated the current population of civet cats. And that was a major public health intervention that helped bring the first outbreak to an end. But eventually, they reopened those markets. And they even allowed, you know, they even allow bats and they allow civets still in some of those markets. And so they're basically saying, we know this happened before, but we don't care enough to regulate these markets or to change the way that the markets are structured so that different animals have to be housed in different areas or anything like that. You know, there's no regulation. And so they've basically set up the situation for it to happen again. And this time it happened and it went a lot further. It's gone a lot further, a lot faster. It's infected many more people. It's affected many more countries. And, you know, we're already over 80,000 deaths worldwide. And I haven't checked the numbers today. Those were yesterday's numbers. So there is some responsibility, and it is responsibility that ultimately falls upon the Chinese government to shut these markets down or to regulate these markets in such a way that these animals are not on top of one another, where you're not setting up artificial environments for transfers that would never take place in nature.
So, yeah, in a sense, what they're doing is they're taking something that's very extremely unlikely to happen in nature, and they're speeding up the amount of permutations and chances that this thing could happen by just having the humans and these other animals all cramped together so tightly.
Yes, it's remarkable to me, you know, as a Christian, it just drives home just the mandate that we have to be good stewards of creation and to care for creation. And, you know, it's really that mandate that leads to humane treatment of animals. And it's really that same mandate that brings dignity to all life, human life in particular, but also to all life. And we've been given this charge as caretakers. And when we disregard knowledge that we have and we treat animals poorly, you know, by trapping and crowding and perhaps even consuming animals that maybe we shouldn't normally be trying to consume. You know, the other thing is bats. I mean, we've known since the original SARS outbreak, if not earlier, that bats harbor hundreds of different kinds of viruses, hundreds of different kinds of coronaviruses, and dozens of other virus families entirely. Nipah virus, Hendra virus, Ebola virus probably originates in bats as well. And so you would think, with that kind of data on hand for decades, that people might think it's a really bad idea to have bats at a human consumption market. It's inviting danger. It's a little bit like jumping into a pit of hungry lions or jumping off of Niagara Falls and hoping for the best, right? You see risk, you know the risk is there, and you choose to disregard it and hope for the best.
What is it about bats that allows them to harbor so many viruses yet not succumb to them?
Yeah, that's pretty typical, you know. So there are viruses that infect all kinds of animals everywhere all the time that aren't associated with any kind of disease. And whether those viruses actually have positive function in those animals, I don't know that most of them do, but it could be that we just haven't been able to identify what those positive functions are. But it's not unusual for a virus to live in a particular animal without detriment to that animal all the time in nature, right? So they're called endogenous hosts. So an animal that has a virus in it all the time and it doesn't have a negative effect on that animal, yeah, that's just a common phenomena in nature.
I guess in a sort of evolutional sense, that's a successful virus, the one that can stay in a host but not kill the host. So in a sense, this new virus that we have, the coronavirus, it's not that successful because it's killing lots of people in a sense.
Well, it's probably very successful in that respect, the way that you've just described it. It's probably very successful in the bat, right? It's not causing the bat harm, and it's hanging out in the bat. We just happen to be an unlucky interloper, right? So
it would be nice if viruses had morals so that they could realize that what they're doing.
Yeah.
The way they talk about viruses, it's sort of like the virus has a strategy.
Yeah, that's the way many people talk about it. I tend to try not to talk about it that way. Occasionally, I'll slip into language that's reflective of that, but it's actually one of my pet peeves. Viruses don't think. They aren't clever. They're not out to preserve their own success. It's just that they're able to persist in the environment until they come in contact with a productive cell, and then that productive cell, for mechanistic reasons, makes more virus. And the successful virus is the virus that doesn't have so many mutations that it can't reproduce itself in future iterations. So, you know, it's a really interesting sort of philosophical question that gets sort of bounced around in the scientific mechanisms. And so, you know, there are evolutionary biologists out there. They're known as extended evolutionary synthesis scientists that they actually think that agency exists at cellular levels, or agency exists perhaps at viral levels.
Seriously.
And seriously. Yeah, absolutely. And to me, I just find that very disconcerting. I find it very unsettling. We observe things in nature and in the laboratory that makes it look as if cells have agency and make it look as if viruses might have agency. But I just think that can't really be true that they actually do, because then you sort of start to get to an idea of science really shouldn't work very well very often, because if there's agency at a cellular level or a molecular level, then it's almost sort of this animistic type model, and you wouldn't expect me to be able to set up, or anyone to be able to set up, an experiment that would have reproducible results if those results were detrimental to the cell or detrimental to the virus, right? You would expect that, oh no, the cells are going to make a choice not to die this time. And so, you know, it's kind of a strange way to think about science. But I think people are sort of led to those types of conclusions because things seem to have goals or purposeful interactions. And apart from a designer or a creator setting things up to function that way, It's hard to explain that sort of sense of goal-oriented or purpose-oriented or purposeful adaptations. So, yeah.
So why do you think that God created viruses?
Well, you know, I think the vast majority of viruses are critical for our flourishing. The vast majority of viruses are keeping the bacterial population in check on planet Earth. And bacteria are really critical for life, too, at the most fundamental level. And so I think there's this brilliant system of checks and balances between something that can't reproduce itself, it needs a living cell, and that the bacteria on planet Earth provide those living cells for the vast majority of viruses. Bacteria are extremely great at reproducing quickly, at adapting to various environments because of the ability to swap genetic information. And bacteria are able to produce amino acids and the foundational building blocks for advanced life. And yet, because bacteria are so good at reproducing and so good at adapting, there really shouldn't be any ecological space for any other life form other than bacteria. And the only reason there is ecological space for other living life forms is because the vast majority of viruses are killing bacteria and keeping the bacterial population in check. And so viruses, for the most part, are creating a diverse and open ecological space for life to flourish, including our life. And so I think it's part of God's design, that at the very base of life itself. Because scientists, virologists will tell you we don't know where viruses come from. Because they're not alive and they can't reproduce themselves without a living cell, they can't have sort of stepwise increased in complexity and reproduction in a Darwinian sense as to their origin. But now that they're here, you know, now that we already have one followed by 31 zeros, number of viruses on planet Earth, they are able to evolve and change and mutate the way that this one's doing slowly through the population. But it's, you know, the fact that we can't point to the origin of viruses, and the best guess is that, you know, maybe they were once part of living cells that have somehow become sort of just broken or defunct machinery, that the only way that they still function is to get inside a cell and use the cell's resources and energy and machinery to make more virus. But that seems an awful lot like a just so naturalistic explanation, trying to leave out any sort of sense of they're here actually for a purpose, and the purpose that they're serving is actually a very good purpose, except when we run into rare cases where we're mismanaging creation and viruses lead to disease. So, yeah, that's how I think about it.
Fascinating.
A lot. Yeah.
I didn't realize that they would need that much to keep the bacterial populations in check.
Yeah, bacteria are amazing. I mean, they're highly diverse, but they are masters of reproduction and they're masters of adaptation. And the fact that they don't really need, you know, many bacteria don't need anything other than sunlight and inorganic compounds to make organic foodstuffs, building blocks, nucleic acids, amino acids. I just don't think that most of us realize that they're primary producers. That's what that phenomenon's called. And they're able to take inorganic nitrogen and fix it into organic compounds. And, you know, not even plants can do that unless it's a legume. But for the most part, plants depend upon bacteria for that nitrogen fixation as well. And so bacteria are at the very foundation of life, the web of life on planet Earth. And that's true. Web of life, whether you look at it from an evolutionary perspective or web of life, you look at it from a creationist perspective where God created ecological balance and fully formed, you know, organisms of a variety of types. So bacteria are critical no matter which worldview you're coming at them from. So
I was a Christian before I went to university, and I went to study applied physics, but I took an elective course on biology, and I enjoyed it so much, and it sort of inspired my faith so much when I saw that these things just had to be designed, and that's why I took a sort of career. Well, I did a biophysics degree, but then after university, I switched to software engineering.
Yeah, it's there are a lot of people that are very impressed with the. With the design that's evident in throughout nature, throughout creation. And, you know, even Francis Crick, who was the one that reminded that he told biologists that they need to constantly keep in mind that what they see isn't designed, but is a process of evolutionary processes. I mean, even that is a confession that the appearance of design is everywhere. And so that's rather troubling, you know, when things are apparent, and when there is always evidence wherever you look, that appearance keeps cropping up over and over and over again, you would think that the burden of proof is on somebody who says, oh, well, things only appear that way, and that the appearance isn't really truly pointing to design. And yet somehow evolution has sort of won the narrative of the day, of the year, of the decade, and it's somehow convinced all the rest of us that the apparent design isn't really design. And yet, I just think it's a mantra that's repeated. I don't even think that the burden of proof is on us. Everywhere we look, we see purpose and design, and we see ecological systems that are networks of interdependence. And it's just really complicated to imagine or even sort through how so much symbiotic, interdependent processes exist everywhere we look, whether we're looking at ecology or whether we're looking at the intricacies of a working cell or a bacteria or how viruses work inside living cells. It's that interdependence, that network, the systems already in place and functioning in concert with other systems and other pathways and other processes. Yeah, I just think it's apparent, and I think it's apparent because it's real. So the design.
Do you need a 5-minute break or something? Because I noticed you coughed there.
Yeah, I'm doing pretty good, but I have another meeting coming up in a few minutes. So I don't know how much more you wanted to talk.
How long have you got? So AJ, I had a brief look at some scientific papers where it seems like this coronavirus can bind to cells in three different ways. And by binding, I mean that, I guess that's by connecting to an outside protein and opening up a channel from which it can enter. Am I correct in that? Or?
Yeah, so, you know, I haven't looked at all of the papers that touch on this, but it's certainly possible that a virus would have a primary receptor. And in the case of SARS and SARS-2, we have strong evidence to believe that that primary receptor in both cases is something called ACE2. And so a virus can have a primary receptor. It can also have a co-receptor. And so what a co-receptor does is it functions as sort of a second step in entry and getting the virus from the outside of the cell to the inside of the cell. And so the virus may bind first to ACE2, and if there's a co-receptor, the co-receptor might facilitate entry once it's bound to the cell. And so I don't know if any of the papers are pointing to co-receptors or if they're pointing to something called alternative receptors. And so you can have a secondary or an alternative receptor that might function on different cell types. So some cells might have ACE2, other cells might not have ACE2, but they might have another protein that allows the virus to bind and enter. And the question becomes, from the scientific perspective, well, which receptor does it bind to more easily with a greater affinity? And that's usually indicated as the primary receptor. And I think there's no reason to believe that in SARS-2 that the primary receptor isn't the same as what was identified in SARS-1, which is the ACE2. So the question becomes, are there alternate receptors? And if there are alternate or secondary receptors, are they important to the disease course? And I think that there's a couple of papers out there that indicate other proteins, a furin-like protein and another protein called CD147, perhaps might serve as alternate receptors. But again, those are just recent observations, and the science that needs to be done to ask the question of, are they sufficient to support entry in and of themselves? You know, one paper I saw was using a type of cell that also has ACE2 as a receptor. So were those properly controlled experiments? Were they ruling out that the virus was using ACE2 and only using this potential alternate receptor? I think they were using drugs that targeted the alternate receptor and showing that had an effect on viral replication. But again, you can't necessarily jump to the conclusion that because it disrupts binding of that protein to the virus protein, the cellular protein alternate receptor to the virus protein, just because it interrupts that process doesn't mean that that's how it's having its inhibitory effect, because there are many other ways that a virus can be inhibited in the course of infection, and especially if it has an alternate primary receptor like ACE2 on the same cell type. So I think if I had more time, I could go through and look at all of those potential alternate receptors. We already knew from SARS-1 that there were a couple of alternate receptors, but we didn't put much emphasis on that because we knew through scientific experimentation that if we could disrupt SARS binding to ACE2, that we could basically inhibit entry and inhibit replication to a point where animal models no longer became sick. And so we knew that that was a primary target, and we knew it was a sufficient primary target. And so the question is, will we know the same about SARS-2? Is it using ACE2 primarily? And if we block that interaction, is that sufficient?
I think that's the real question. This is fascinating stuff. I know you're a busy lady. You've got a meeting coming up. But for me, this is better than watching Netflix, because it's just a geek fest for me, just catching up on biology that I never got the chance to really do as a career.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Nikos. I enjoyed the conversation with you. And you're a rare bird in that way. You know, most people, their eyes sort of glaze over when you start getting too much into the technical details. But it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, likewise, AJ. So anyway, thanks for your time, and have a good week, and we'll catch up with you some point in the future. So.
Great. God bless. Stay safe.
Okay, well, that was AJ from Reasons to Believe. You can go check her out on the show notes, and thanks for listening to the Influencers Cafe. See you again next time. Bye-bye.